Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In series two, we worked our way through an assortment of added Beatles goodies, such as Live at the BBC, the anthology series, and the movies. For series three, we will be looking at the post-Beatles singles released in the decade following their breakup. But for now, in this mid-series special, we are here for a big birthday bonanza to celebrate a certain Paul's 80th birthday. And I'll give you a clue. It's not our Paul, is it?
It's not. No. I'm getting older. Not that old.
No. It's definitely not. So yeah, we're here for Paul McCartney's 80th birthday special.
Hooray!
I'm sure we're the only podcasters who even thought of doing this.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought there'd be anything else that anyone should have to go and listen to. Just listen to this and that's it. Then put down your phone and go for a walk.
Yes. That's it. I'll do the usuals. Don't forget you can follow us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or email us at bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. You know, as always, please do like and share our posts and tell everyone all about us all the time. So we've been away a few weeks since series two. Paul, have you been up to anything whilst we've been away?
I've had a few gigs with my band, Good Grief, one of which you came to. You came to watch us play in a cupboard in Worcester.
essentially.
So that's all in support of our album, Shake Your Faith, which is available now. Not many copies left in the UK on actual vinyl anyway. Mm. So it's been selling fairly well, which is quite nice. So
well done.
Yes, that's mainly what we've been doing is popping out here and there for a few little gigs.
Good stuff.
And what have you been doing, Gary?
Well, actually, I've been doing similar before. Well, not recently, but I'll get to that. But yeah, I've been doing my first live performances for a long, long, long time. So I've been doing little acoustic nights with my buddy Chris Cope, playing some of my music, a couple in Stafford and one here in Stoke-on-Trent. And that's been nice to kind of get some of my original music.
You're the Midlands troubadour.
Yeah. And then that's all come to an end because as we've talked about before, I've had my knee operation. So I have mostly been sitting down and resting my knee. So That's
what happens.
That's what happens. But it's all gone well. But I'm just in the recovery stage. So I'm sitting here. If I sound slightly tinnier or a little less clear than usual, I'm not sitting in my usual studio setup. I'm in a more comfortable sofa with a headset on. So, but it's all gone well. And thank you for everyone's lovely messages on Twitter. That was very, very nice to read.
Yes.
It was very, very nice. Oh, also, I got my latest song out is called Model, and it has some hints of Lady Madonna in it, I think. So there's a bit of a piano part thing in there, which you might recognise some influence on. So you might find it interesting. It is linked, as always, to the podcast description, I hope. Well, Paul, we should also stick with On This Beatles Day.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And I can't even think what you might be doing for this day. So I'm all ears.
So the day today is the 18th of June, and I was going to be a horrible troll and just find something completely irrelevant, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. So what I've actually done is I've not chosen the 18th of June 1942, I've chosen the 18th of June of every year of the 1960s.
Okay.
Because those are all McCartney birthday days.
Okay, so you've not gone for the birthday.
I've gone for several birthdays, as best as we know them on. I presume there'll be someone somewhere who'll know exactly what happened on the two or three, you know, years where there isn't specific information about his birthday.
Okay.
But there is quite a fair bit, which is interesting, because obviously, as you know, the 50s turn into the 60s, and he's a 17-year-old, and he becomes an 18-year-old in 1960.
Yeah.
So here we go. I'm going to do a quick rundown of what we know about the 1960s birthdays of Paul McCartney. So in 1960, we know that he's been playing live at the Grosvenor Ballroom in Wallasey. Okay. Think probably billed at the time as the Silver Beatles, spelt one of two ways, depending on the poster. And so a bunch of gigging going on in those early days. That's how he spends his 18th birthday, playing a gig. That's quite nice. He spends his 19th birthday, 1961, playing at the Top Ten Club in Hamburg as part of their really long residency they do in Hamburg. So it's like 79 of 92 nights.
Right.
So his birthday, I suspect he probably didn't remember much of that birthday.
No.
Anyway, he turns 20 in 1962, and there isn't specific information about what happened on the exact day. It was a Monday, so possibly it was just a day off from doing stuff, but They'd come back from another Hamburg stint at the start of that month. They'd done their first proper session in Abbey Road earlier that month, and most of what they were doing around this time was playing in the Cavern in lunches and evenings. Mm. So I think they were basically back up in Liverpool, rehearsing, playing, but this is a day where we don't know that they did anything.
Okay.
1963, his 21st birthday, a very significant birthday. So he has a nice big party at Auntie Jin's house in Highton, here in Liverpool, and that's where John assaults Bob Wooler.
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was so funny. That's that weird time when they're just on the cusp of fame and John could have really just ruined it for everyone.
Yeah.
But this isn't about John, it's about Paul. So we move on to 1964. His birthday is celebrated on the day that they do their first Australian show in Sydney.
Ah.
They have a press conference, they do a show, then they have a party at the hotel with a bunch of girls who won a newspaper competition.
Oh, dear.
It's just like, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird because why would you want a load of randoms at your birthday party anyway?
Hmm.
And it's also weird because it's like, oh, here's a bunch of girls at the Daily Mail's rounded up for you or the Mirror or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's...
I'm sure they were just shepherded in there for a little while and shepherded out again, but it's just creepy. It's not nice.
You'd hope, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Anyway, 1965, we don't know what's happening exactly. It's a mixing session is in the studio, so they were possibly there. But we do know that there are photos of that day of the band on top of the Palladium, literally on top of the building of the Palladium,
right,
with John and George hoisting Paul onto their shoulders with Ringo stands on laughing. Ha ha ha, he says. Mm. But the Palladium was next to the NEMS building, so Brian's London office.
Mm.
So clearly they were just doing some business, some Beatles business, and they popped up there to get some, you know, birthday photos done,
okay,
with the newspapers. And I didn't know where the photos were taken, but coincidentally, Joe Wisby from the Beatles Books podcast replied to a picture I'd put up and said where it was. So thanks, Joe.
Right.
1966, we don't know about the exact day, but the day before his birthday, he'd bought himself a farm in Scotland.
That's a good enough birthday present to yourself. What birthday was that? His 25th or something?
24th. And clearly the tax man had said, spend some money.
Yeah.
And so he's like, well, I'll buy a farm in Scotland. And obviously that goes on to play quite a big part in his in his life.
Yeah.
But they were sort of in the sessions for recording and mixing songs on Revolver at the time. 1967, again, no specific thing on the day that I can tell you exactly, except for the fact there are some photos of him again, sat at home with cards from fans. And there's a photo of him holding a kitten, which is quite nice.
Oh.
So presumably another media interview he fitted in there. This was sort of in the midst of them recording All You Need Is Love.
Yeah.
1968, it's, I think, basically some Apple business going on during the day. And then, depending on where you read, it says, Paul celebrates at Apple without any of the others present, so he invites in some Apple scruffs to have tea with him. Which is a bit, it's not unlike inviting in the competition winners from Sydney. Yeah. But actually, that evening, John goes to the theatre with Yoko. He's pictured in the newspapers with Yoko before he's left Cynthia. George and Ringo are apparently in San Francisco, and then Paul goes off to see Jane Asher in a play in Oxford.
Right.
And then 1969, we don't know, because by this point in 1969, the Beatles are ostensibly, I think they are what the boys on Nothing Is Real podcast have described as Schrodinger's Beatles.
Right.
You know, they're neither a band nor not a band, yeah. And you know, so they're not really hanging around much and there's not much evidence. John and Yoko are off on their peace trail.
Mm.
The Ballad of John and Yoko is in the charts, so it's, I can't tell you much about that. But that was my brief overview of McCartney's birthdays during the 1960s, and I'm sure he actually had a lovely time for most of them.
Yes, and it sounds like he didn't, not one of them, was it just he had a day off and just didn't do anything.
No,
it's all recording, playing.
But you can do that when you're in your 20s, can't you? You've got the energy for doing that stuff.
Yeah.
When you get a bit older, it's like, if I've got a birthday party, I'd like to plan it in advance and have nothing around it and save myself for it.
Yeah, his situation's slightly different, isn't it? You know, I never work on my birthday, but then my work isn't being a Beatle.
That's very true.
If it was, I'd probably think, hey, great, play a gig on my birthday, fantastic, you know. Well, thanks for that on this Beatles days. I just thought you were going to go for the for the obvious birthday and say, but then I guess what would he, what was Paul McCartney doing? He was being born in as much detail as you care to
although there is imagine. There is testimony from Jim McCartney, his dad, saying he was the ugliest baby I'd ever seen. He was all sort of red and wrinkled.
Oh,
and
they are, though. Well, my daughter looked like a goblin when she came out because her face had all been smooshed up.
Yeah.
I used to call her goblin. She's beautiful now.
She is. She's a very beautiful little girl.
So, great. It's going to be a bit rambling quick, isn't it, this one?
We just wanted to celebrate McCartney. We didn't want to let the occasion go unmarked because it's not like... There's no Beatle that's unimportant, but to have someone like Paul McCartney be, you know, about to turn 80, still playing music, still really... He's creating new music. He's still celebrating the legacy of the stuff he's done. And obviously you went through the exercise of ranking all the Beatles things.
Yeah.
So let's take a McCartney-specific look at some of it.
Okay, so shall I go through the top 10? Harkening back to Series 1 scores and extracting out purely the McCartneys, let's look at the top 10 McCartneys from my list.
I thought this is interesting, right, before we get into actually what it is, because people might have forgotten, or they might have never have listened, who knows. But I was imagining at one point, like we do this episode, he's like, well, what if your top, say, 20 were like a McCartney Beatles compilation? And I looked at the top 20 and I looked at the top 10 and you know what? It's funny. These are all amazing songs. I think it'd make a dreadful compilation and it'd be massively, it'd somehow be ultra representative of him as an artist and also massively unrepresentative of him as an artist because of where your enthusiasms lie for the type of songs you like.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't. So I want everyone to imagine what would it be like if suddenly they put out a 10-track album of McCartney Beatles things, and it was these 10.
Okay, then. All right, keep with that in mind. Then I'll go in reverse order and say that maybe this is the imagine the album listing builds to a climax. Yeah. It starts with "Lovely Rita."
Yay.
Standing by a parking meter when I caught a glimpse of Rita filling in the ticket in a little white book. Look much older, and the bag across her shoulder made her look a little like a military man.
I ranked 23rd, but it is the 10th top McCartney one.
Yeah.
Good, lovely Rita. I mean, that's a...
It's very much a McCartney story song. Well, it's kind of a story, isn't it? It's one of his Imagine a Person songs.
Yeah.
Which is a McCartney trait.
Yes, a very good one of his. I wonder how many more songs will fit into that genre in this collection.
It's one of those songs where the actual story behind it is keeps getting different versions, of course. And we talked a little bit about this in the main thing. So apparently there was a real-life warden whose name was Meta Davies, who had written him up a ticket, and there's all the sort of news coverage of her. You know, and then like in the Sgt. Pepper box set, they sort of say that it's about an American friend of Paul's telling him that traffic wardens were called meter maids in the States. So maybe it's a couple of both of them. And then in Paul's lyrics book, which obviously has come out since we did the main series, he says it was one particular meter maid who he spotted opposite the Chinese embassy in Portland Place in London. So, so that maybe that was Meter Davies or something like that. So
it's that ability to turn such a small bit of inspiration into a song and then...
A glimpse or an incident.
Yeah, and then that Sgt. Pepper's backing behind it that makes it everything have this that strange juxtaposition of rock psychedelic versus kind of progressive rock and slightly psychedelic versus just mundane, really. You know, she's a meter maid. It's not much of a story, is it, in some ways, but it's the way it combines. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. And also, this is worth listening to because of McCartney bass lines.
Yeah.
This is one of the ones, I think probably one of the first ones where he literally was like, I'm going to record the bass line separately after we've done everything else.
Yeah.
And I'm going to sit and I'm going to work on it for hours.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah.
Because otherwise he's playing the piano in the main backing track. Yeah. And then he goes off and does the bass later separately.
So he's starting to, Oh, we'll get onto that because we're going to talk about Beatles bass lines. Mm-hmm. A little bit after this. So this next on the list at number 9 of the top 10, but 21 in my list originally, is Blackbird.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly.
So thematically, less of, this is a different side of McCartney's lyrics from when you look at it that way. You know, it's not about a small incident writ large. It's about a large theme made small in metaphor, you know.
Yes, that's an interesting way to put it, of course. Yeah. So obviously we, it's known about, this is the idea of the solidarity of strength of like a black woman is what he, how he phrases it, talks about it. So he uses the symbol of the blackbird as to, you know, tie together this theme of strength and try, unity, solidarity. You could possibly argue that it's a little bit of a strange metaphor to use. We, you know, as a white man in England with very different, different things acting on him as a person, but it's an astonishing way to do that. And even without knowing that, it remains very obvious that it's not actually a song about a blackbird that's knackered.
Yeah, with bad wings.
Yeah, been got by a cat.
It'd be great if Paul McCartney's story was, oh no, there was just this blackbird I found once, and it had broken wings, so I nursed it back.
Oh, it just stove its head in.
No, it's very, I mean, I've told the story in the main podcast about how I sang this at our year 11 as leaving ceremony do in front of all my peers and their parents, and that the theme that when people came to me and said, oh, that was, I remember that, because without any of that knowledge of this meaning of the song quite evidently is about overcoming or change.
Yes.
You know, so overcoming problems or transitioning from one thing to another, which made it very poignant for a leaving do as you were leaving school to become, you know, ostensibly adults, you know, and start making your own decisions about things. So I think, you know, that theme rings true. And I wasn't doing it for that reason. I was doing it because I had a mate who could play it on guitar who needed to do something for his GCSE performance, and I needed to sing something for my GCSE performance. The fact that it coincided with that theme was great. But it's, as with all good songs, really. Well, I say that we've just had Lovely Rita. It's super specific, you know, and you can't go away from Lovely Rita going, ah, that means a lot to me. It reminds me of when I was a meter maid. With Blackbird, it's one of those songs you can, it's universal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And such a great bit of guitar fiddlery.
Yeah, based on the Bach guitar pattern, you know. You know. McCartney with an acoustic guitar is a force to be reckoned with.
Sure is. And that takes us to our next song, at number 8, original position to 20 in the main list, which is Yesterday.
Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, and yesterday came suddenly. Why
is
she?
Yeah, there's almost nothing you can say about this song, isn't there? So.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, yeah, it's just so good. And again, this is more a universal McCartney. This is anyone could listen to that song, conjure up anything, unless they've lived a charmed life, conjure up anything from their past and shed a little tear.
Yeah, and he records this just before his 23rd birthday. I mean, this is such a mature song.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well, and I mentioned it as well. He records it on a session where he recorded I'm Down before it.
I recorded I'm Down?
Yeah, he's recorded I'm Down, and then he's still got the voice to do this.
So we'll move on from Yesterday to number 7, which was originally 19 in the list, which is The Fool on the Hill.
The fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
Great song.
It is.
What else to say about it without treading too much of the old ground?
The only thing I'd say is I did look in the lyric book about this one, because obviously it was going to be in his lyrics book. When we were talking about where the lyrics came from, there was Alistair Taylor, the, you know, who used to be Epstein's assistant, worked in Apple, and said that him and McCartney had been walking in Primrose Hill in North London. A man appeared before them and suddenly vanished.
Yes.
Yeah, and then they were talking about the existence of God, and then McCartney writes Fool on the Hill, according to Alistair Taylor. In the lyrics book, there's no mention of that.
Right, what does McCartney say?
He says it's about the Maharishi.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it's a bit funny because at this point, it's 1967 that they're recording this. Mm. They'd only known him a little bit at this point. They hadn't been away to India to spend time with him. And he's saying it's not meant to be derogatory in this sense, that calling him a fool.
No, I've never.
It's the way the way people are treating him, sort of thing. Mm. But yeah, supposedly about the Maharishi, even though he'd met him four times or something.
Quite a big figure to kind of meet, though, and to kind of the impact would, and for a songwriter like, you know, for songwriters like McCartney and Lennon who are looking for any input they can put through the cogs.
Yeah,
you know, it wouldn't take much. I kind of always thought it was slightly, I guess because the Magical Mystery Tour video, I always thought it was slightly meant to be semi-autobiographical for some reason.
Self-reflective.
Yeah, but it never really made sense. I just love the way it encapsulates the feeling of isolation I think we can all have at times. You can never really know if anyone else really exists.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And I think that's the Fool on the Hill can make you, I think we can all be the Fool on the Hill, Paul.
Yes, I think you're right.
I think there's a little fool on the hill in all of
inside
us.
All of us, yeah.
Okay, number six, She's Leaving Home, which was number 18 on my chart.
Father snores as his wife gets into her dressing gown. Picks up the letter that's lying there, standing alone at the top of the stairs. She breaks down and cries to her husband, Daddy, our baby's gone.
I mean, big waves as far as how songs are constructed and put together. You said about Lovely Rita having the first time he took away the bass line to go and work on it post kind of main rhythm section. I mean, he took away everything. They took away everything for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we know it's the four violins, the two violas, two celli, one double bass, or possibly bass and violin, which is a different thing, and a harp. Mm. I said celli then to try and sound like I was saying
it. I was just hoping
proper,
you...
The proper
that was
plural.
Right, and you knew that was right.
Yeah. And we know all about the fact that he was so eager to get this recorded that he got someone else to write the score up and upset George Martin and all sort of that. So
yeah,
but it's again in terms of like if you've got Lovely Rita as a story of the image of seeing someone of a parking meter person across the road, here you've got a newspaper article that just by sheer weird coincidence then has some Beatles-related backstory.
Yes, which you told us about, and I would urge you to go and listen to in episode 40 of Series 1, if you've not heard the story to that. We won't recap it here, but it's got a very weird circularity about it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's just, again, one of the weird Beatles coincidences.
Yes. Great. Number 5, Lady Madonna, which was number 16.
Friday night arrives without a suit. Sunday morning, creeping like a nun. Monday's child has learned to tie his bootlace. See how they run.
Just a bit of boogie woogie.
Well, it's sort of stride blues type thing. Yeah. It's based essentially on Bad Penny Blues by Humphrey Lyttelton, which was released on Parlophone in the 50s. And it was sort of done as in, let's get something out for release before we go off to Rishikesh.
Yeah.
And it's great. I love this song. It's great guitar, great bass. The piano part is fantastic. It's a lovely studio construction, but still has that Ace sort of, the vibe you want of that type of song.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing with Lady Madonna. This is one of his, what we refer to as wind-up songs, I think. Once the parts are in place, the song could never do anything but what it does. It's like it has to be. I don't know if I'm explaining that very well when I say it like that, but it just feels as a music.
It forms into what it's always intended to be. Yeah. It's like no matter how you stretch and pull it, it always wants to be Lady Madonna.
If you're sitting playing Lady Madonna, that's where your fingers are going next with every chord change, with every passing note. You can't imagine there were many other options he could have taken with it, but you still needed to have found that start. It's like picking at a seam and then being able to pull the song out, where some songs are lots of seams put together. This is one where his genius was just to find that thread in the first place, and then boom, whole song. I mean, it just works as a... It's kind of musically precise.
Yeah, and it still in the lyrics combines some of the stuff we've been talking to already, because he sort of goes on about the concept of, you know, the Madonna, the Virgin Mary, as a sort of symbol for womanhood, as a notion. But it's also inspired by a copy, you know, an image in National Geographic magazine. So it's sort of a couple of different McCartney type things.
It's mixing his world up,
forming together into this weird sort of stompy bluesy thing.
Absolutely. So, next on the list, at number 4 on out of our top 10, but 12 in my original list, is Let It Be.
And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see.
And read, you know, Let It Be, innit?
It is, yeah.
I mean, it's obviously been a big feature of this year with everything that was released with Get Back and everything.
And we've got the two versions, of course. You've got the album version and the single version with the different sort of mixes and guitars and things.
Yeah,
like that, so.
Of which I think originally, I mean, I quite like the Spectre overblownness. But I mean, at the core of it all, it doesn't really matter because it's a good song. I always get the feeling that when you watch Get Back, and there's all this, you know, there's the slight amount of acrimony that we originally thought, but you can see that they're going in different directions. They want their own influence and their own voices in there and things like that. But you can just feel almost a sense of respectful resignation from everyone that when Paul McCartney comes up with something like Let It Be, it's like, well, we're going to have to put that out then, aren't we? You know, it's just no matter what their thoughts and arguments and John Lennon's post-Beatles things were about, you know, when someone turns up with something like Let It Be, there's no question that you're going to put something like that out, isn't there? So it's just an instant epic classic.
Yeah.
Of which I'm sure there'll be another one to talk about. The next one, number 3 of our top 10, but it was number 11 in my list, which reminds me how few, there was only a couple of McCartney ones in the top 10, wasn't there? But then he dominates pretty much the rest of the top 20.
You only had 2 of your top 10 were Paul McCartney songs.
Yeah, but only when you look at it in that sense, though, in the sense that he was the main...
And when you look at it in terms of the system that you invented.
Yeah, but number 3 anyway was Eleanor Rigby.
Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care, all the lonely people?
Well, I mean, we've kind of covered, again, the type of song this is through the ones before as well. You factor in Yesterday, factor in She's Leaving Home, you've got Eleanor Rigby, but you've just got this strange, not bleakness, darkness, I think, to it. It's, you know, it's essentially 2 chords, more or less, and he makes this out of it. It's insane.
Well, this is the thing with someone, I mean, McCartney in later years is sometimes has been accused of kind of, yeah, I don't know, what's the word, with his bouncy love songs, happy stuff. But I mean, no one conjures a mood like things like She's Leaving Home and Eleanor Rigby and The Fool on the Hill for and many of the others as well, for their kind of, you know, their moodier and slightly darker side of things, let alone his, I mean, it's not on this list because Maxwell Silverhammer and that weirdness. But yeah, Eleanor Rigby, I think a lot of people love Eleanor Rigby.
You know that there's a gravestone to Eleanor Rigby in St. Peter's Churchyard in Woolton, which apparently didn't inspire the song, even though he's definitely been to that place, because it's just over the road from where he first met John Lennon at Woolton Village Fete in the Village Hall, which I went to for the first time. I've lived in this city nearly 25 years, and for the first time when I was in Woolton the other day, I walked up to see the Village Hall and to have a walk around St. Peter's Churchyard, and I found the Eleanor Rigby gravestone.
Right.
Which, even though it's got nothing to do with him actually writing the song, it's just another mad Beatles coincidence.
Absolutely, yeah.
It is such a strange thing to see, you know, and to know that the other people in the graveyard as well have all gone there to look at it.
Mm.
It's just like, this is a bit weird. So I made sure I had a look at some other dead people's gravestones as well.
Just to balance it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two of our top 10, number 10 in my top list of all Beatles songs, is Hey Jude.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her under your skin.
What a long song.
It is a long song, isn't it? I mean, it's another Let It Be in the sense that, again, you just get the feeling, because at the time, isn't John looking at things like Revolution and things like that? And again, must have just been like, oh, well, we'll have to put this out then, won't we?
Yeah, John sort of having to concur that Hey Jude is phenomenal. And I talked about it at the time, and plenty of people have said it. It's very easy to take Hey Jude for granted because of its relationship to McCartney over the years. And it's, oh, he always plays it at the end of his shows. I don't know if I'm bothered about that, until he does it and you're there. And it's like, no, just don't let it stop.
Yeah.
Keep asking different groups of the audience to sing bits. but the record itself is, again, it's phenomenal. It's a brilliant record. I love that. Then it's got a certain odd little bits of scrappiness to it as well. If you listen really closely, you can hear them swearing in it. You know, and then if you listen really closely, I've got my shiny new headphones. Mm. Like in the outro, you can hear so much of McCartney just over, I think, in the right headphone, in the stereo mix, sort of like G-ing everyone up and all the sorts of weird things he's saying that's almost imperceptible, like in the hearing. It's just such a good song.
It is. I think there was just a patch in the 2000s where, I think it was with the Olympics and other things and stuff, that McCartney seemed to be on the telly every 2 days playing it as an outro to something or other, wasn't he?
I think
that's maybe died down a little bit, but you're right, absolutely right. Why wouldn't you? I'd play Hey Jude every gig I did if I'd written it. So that leaves us at number one on our top 10 McCartneys, which was number five in my top 10 Beatles, which is Penny Lane.
Penny Lane is in my ears and in my eyes.
It's funny, really. It's a strange one, seeing it put out like this, that Penny Lane's there. But I think I feel a bit take it or leave it in some ways with Penny Lane. But I think when you look at it with, like I did, remembering that Series 1 was my strange scoring system, which didn't really work out. It didn't really bring much soul to it, but it did look at, you know, production wise and lyrics wise.
Yeah, you were hidebound by the category.
Yeah, I was. But yeah, it does deserve its place. It's such a technically brilliant song.
Yeah, it is. Just, it's texturally. So you've got, I mean, a single that's got Strawberry Fields on one side and Penny Lane on the other is just a gift to humanity.
Yeah.
You know, it's the different ways, because they're both texturally based songs.
Yeah.
You know, they're both mood based songs. Obviously, Penny Lane's a bit more bumpy, 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 bumpy,
yeah,
if that makes sense. But when you actually break it down, the layers of piano, organs, all the sounds in there, the trumpet solo, the little imagey nods in there, like the double bass and all that sort of stuff. Just great.
It is just great. And it also encapsulates the two sides of McCartney's ability to be happy and boppy, but also create a mood in an instance. It literally in the first kind of time it hits a minor chord on the descent. And at that point, you suddenly, it's like, oh, this isn't just a dum 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 major chord everything. It's like, oh, there's something strange and slightly off about everything. It's a bit dreamy. You know, it's
also got sexual innuendo in it.
Yeah. It's It is fantastic, but it is strange for me seeing it in front of me, thinking, oh, is that my top Paul McCartney? So I don't know, obviously, as I said, I caveated heavily that, you know, these can change on a whim at any point, really, as far as what I actually just, if I was just to do a put one on top of the other type of way of ranking things rather than using scores. But like our friends at Ranking the Beatles have done.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a completely different list. But still, I think it's a fairly representative and very good top 10, showing our appreciation for Mr. McCartney.
So let me just do a quick rundown of it again then. Yeah. So at 10, Lovely Rita. Number 9, Blackbird. Number 8, Yesterday. Number 7, Fool on the Hill. Number 6, She's Leaving Home. Number 5, Lady Madonna. Number 4, Let It Be. Number 3, Eleanor Rigby. Number 2, Hey Jude. And at number 1, Penny Lane.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it would be a bad collection, but I don't think
it's
it would...
32 minutes of pure McCartney.
Yeah, I don't think it would flow as a collection, especially not in that
no,
order.
No, it would be a dreadful collection.
It's strange. You would want more of a variety of some of his other stuff, wouldn't you, really?
But yeah, well, I... Go
on, no.
I tried to come up with a top 10, a sort of career-spanning top... Beatles career-spanning top 10.
Yeah.
And it was really hard.
Oh.
And I couldn't really pick, so I... It's like, for instance, I love P.S. I Love You, but
oh yeah, yeah.
Would I put that into my top 10 of like of an early one when I Saw Her Standing There exists?
Mm.
I don't know. So let's put I Saw Her Standing There aside because it's almost like that's existed since rock and roll existed. It feels like it should have been there forever.
Yeah.
So let's say my top 10 would be, and I was doing this in more sort of a career spanning way, just off the top of my head. Again, could change any second. P.S. I Love You, Paperback Writer,
mm-hmm.
I'm Down,
mm-hmm.
Another Girl,
mm-hmm.
I'm Looking Through You,
mm-hmm.
Got to Get You Into My Life,
mm-hmm.
Fixing a Hole, Hello Goodbye, Mother Nature's Son,
mm-hmm.
And You Never Give Me Your Money.
Oh, I mean, there's just so much in there, isn't there? That's
I know, yeah.
And so many of those fell out of my list because of certain things to do with production that you just don't really care about as a normal listener. You know, you just happily pass you by, but when you're being objective. Yeah, there's a lovely section. And P.S. I Love You is one that scored really, really low.
And that's one that you re-ranked, didn't you?
I gave it a boost but yeah. Because...
Because it was lingering in your
head,
wasn't
it? Yeah,
it
still does, and I still think it's great. It's still gaining favour the longer it goes on.
That's excellent.
That's a good list. But what we should mention as well is, apart from all these, you know, kind of all round glowing examples of his genius as the main writer, we have to remember is he influenced so many of all the other songs not credited to him specifically. You know, he wasn't just a passenger on those songs, was he?
No, not at all.
He's a major. A major force in the arrangement, the lyrics, the occasional drumming and guitar cameos. And also, we're talking Beatles, because as is our remit. But, mm-hmm. You know, if I was doing a top 10 McCartney list, without, you know, admittedly not knowing everything he's done, because I've not listened to all of his solo albums, there's no way that you wouldn't, you know, Live and Let Die and Maybe I'm Amazed and Let Me Roll It to You and Put It There. Those would probably be up there,
yeah.
You know, amongst others.
Wanderlust, stuff off Ram. Yeah, there's just... I mean, his output is so massive as well that in a strange way, it's got to the point now where his less impressive stuff, or the stuff that you like less, let's say, that's a better way of putting it, you can kind of ignore because there's so much material and so much of it is either good, very good, or exceptional.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I don't mind... I think he was more focused with the Beatles because he was one of four with, you know, for a large part of it with a management structure and a kind of a, you know, a filter to push up against. And I think he earned, if he wanted to put out five solo albums where the hit rate might not have been as high, I think he earned that, you know, the freedom to do that. I mean, we all have the freedom to do that, but just no one particularly will listen. You know, he had the freedom to do that with people who would listen because of who he is and what he'd done. Should we move on, Paul?
Yeah.
To something I wanted to talk a bit about, because one thing we should not overlook with McCartney, we've talked about his writing, but obviously his main instrument in the Beatles was the bass. And as both you and I are bassists, and I owe pretty much my whole based education almost exclusively to Paul McCartney and yourself originally. You know, you put me onto the Beatles anyway. And when we started playing guitars, it, obviously the first thing I start playing is Beatles stuff. And if I remember rightly, the first bass line I really mastered was All My Loving.
Yes.
Which I learned to play as fast as I possibly could. So that when I played it at normal speed, it felt easy. And that's how I started off. And it was on the bottom four strings of an acoustic guitar.
Yes, yeah.
Because dad wouldn't let me have a bass unless I proved that I was going to be able to learn a bit. So I had to learn some normal chords.
And I needed someone to play bass because I wasn't going to play bass, because why would you? You want to be a guitarist.
Yeah. So you had me...
like Paul McCartney did. And then he got forced to play bass. I forced you to play bass. And then it turns out that
You ended up playing bass.
Moved to Liverpool with lots of people who are much, much better guitarists than me, and there's too few bassists.
Yeah, so my first song, I wanted to talk about a few of his bass lines that have influenced me, and these are just the ones that come immediately to mind, not picking through the whole list where I'm sure there's loads. But the first one is All My Loving.
I'll pretend that I'm kissing the lips.
The seamless flow of All My Loving is its genius. So constructing walking bass lines to hit the passing chords and notes in blues scales is one thing when you're working on a kind of normal 12-bar rock and roll. But All My Loving isn't just a normal 12-bar rock and roll. It has flourishes of
minor... and all sorts of mad chords.
Yeah,
it
has minor chords and shifts and things in the choruses. And, you know, it inverts when it gets to the solo. You know, it starts on the second chord and all these things. Yet all the while, this bass just do 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 do. It just keeps on going all the way through and tying it all together, doesn't it? It's a real flowing bass line, but it's one you can't just what key's it in, because it doesn't work. If you played All My Loving with anything but that bass line, it wouldn't sound right, would it?
No, it'd be rubbish. Yeah. And also, what you have to remember with the bass line to All My Loving is Paul McCartney had to play that and sing it.
Yeah,
which is nuts, because it's. It does, you know, what, like you say, you can learn it by rote because you demonstrated that, and but it's very hard to do that and concentrate on singing well
as I remember
that sort of song.
Because I used to sing the backing with you at one point.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very good. And then, next one, from a sheer energy point of view, talk about playing and singing, but this is more about your movement of your fingers, is I saw her standing there.
Well, she was just 17.
As we know, has been cunningly lifted from a Chuck Berry song.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But with several 100% more energy put into it, I think it's there's more attack and it's tempo on the Beatles one as I remember. But I mean, have you ever played All My? I saw her standing there on the bass all the way through.
No, I've not. No,
it's a finger cruncher for sure. You know, it's a good one for getting your fingers moving, and it's relentless and it's great to play, and it's another one from the early days where it's like, wow, if I can get through a song playing this, then I'm going to get through anything slower and easier. So but then where it really starts to shine for me is when he gets into the studio and we start to hear it with things like, oh, it's funny you're saying about, you know, obviously Sergeant Pepper's when he starts to take them offline a little bit and work on them, but by before that we're starting to hear things like Rain and Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah.
His fluency to work around non-standard kind of scales, so he's not just working in blues scales. He's starting to add layers to songs that are not just added value. They're kind of essential to the song itself. I mean, imagine Rain without the bass doing what it's doing, you know, or Taxman.
Yeah.
You know, similar type of modes as well, and those kind of bass lines. Because arguably, quite a lot of his earlier songs, he's just got to, like you were saying, singing and playing, he's just got to play them. They're often following a bit more conventional rock and roll, but not massively. And he's hitting the root and the fifth, and that's how he
yeah. It's a fundamental to bass playing, is that sort of root note, fifth note, sort of bum, ba bum, bum, ba bum, bum, ba bum, bum. And that happens.
Yeah, it has to.
It's how you use that as part of your arsenal of
exactly,
skills to do stuff, because it's still essential, you know, and it's still an essential part of bass playing is groove, which you're often at risk of losing if you're doing too much.
Exactly. You've got to keep
shifting around. You've got to balance it.
You've got to keep some low end root note stuff going on somewhere. Or if you're not doing that, it has to be the right time not to do that. And when you start learning the bass and listening to bass lines, and if you're not noticing the bass, it can be good. But if you're noticing the bass and it's not detracting from the song, then you're into something really good. You know, it's because, you know, some people will never leave that root note and it's fine. It doesn't affect the, it makes the song solid. But if you're starting to add things to the song with your bass and you're not lacking anything, you've really started to enhance everything there, haven't you? And by the time he gets to things like With a Little Help from My Friends, you know, and all those bouncy counter melodies over the 12th fret, we're into groundbreaking bass territory for me there. That's one that I remember being really enamored with.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
But what's strange is he, unless you can tell me otherwise, he barely seems to acknowledge it. I remember seeing a quote from him in Bassist magazine 20 odd years ago, where I think he basically said he was quite proud to be a bassist. I think he was kind of like, I'm quite proud to be a bassist. I get the feeling he kind of worries more about the writing of the songs and the focus is on that. And as a byproduct, he's kind of unwittingly one of the best bassists to ever lived, but doesn't really think about it that much.
No, you're right, because he is a bass icon, but he's never been a bass icon in the sense of, like, here he is with a picture of Trace Elliott amps that he's advertising, and Paul McCartney uses such and such strings. Mm. He doesn't know what strings he uses. You know, he's still playing his Hofner violin bass.
Yeah.
He's brilliant, but I think it's his personal sense of the all-roundedness of a musician and songwriter means that he's never perhaps given himself necessarily the credit that he deserves for being a bass player, because he's astonishing.
Yeah. And just a couple more I want to mention. By the end of his career, with a flamboyant and upfront bass in songs like Come Together and I Want You, I think, you know, we're just reaching a level of bass legendary, you know, there. Mm. So my little list, before you tell us about your little listener's little list of ones that just came to mind when I was thinking about it, but there's loads of us. All My Loving, I Saw Her Standing There, Rain, Tomorrow Never Knows, With a Little Help from My Friends, I Want You and Come Together, they're the ones I've just mentioned there, but there's so many more. So I'm really interested to see what did our listeners on Twitter say, Paul? What exactly did you ask them?
I basically said, what's your fave Macca bass part? And lots of folks replied, and it was interesting to see what came in. Because obviously some people just suggested like a few lists of different things that they like, and some folks suggested one or two specific things. So what's really interesting out of this is the thing that cropped up most notably out of all of them was Dear Prudence.
Because it's got that octave-y
jump. And it is a fantastic bass. I mean, it's a fantastic song. It's one of my absolute favourites. And it's got what could be a very simple bass line, a descending bass part. Dum, 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 dum. Mm. But he doesn't do that. He does dum, bum, 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 bum. I have to sing it up an octave or two here to do it. So he doesn't take the obvious path with it.
Yeah.
He does these octave leaps to keep it interesting, and also to leave the low end free for when he needs to do the second sections of stuff. And and again, it's textural and works really well, like when he's doing the look around bit, where it's just doing sort of repeated patterns that sort of like rolls through the song, which is lovely. So I was amazed. I wasn't amazed because
I'm surprised that really.
But it cropped up really quickly. Loads of people. So we got people like Tim Kellaway, someone called Court, Raul Sanchez Uribarri, Izzy, whose screen name is @BrokenAglass, which is brilliant. Lisa at With a Little Look, Thorsten Rock, Jamie at Alphabeticals, and Joe Kane from the Popper Most. They all suggested Dear Prudence.
Okay.
And the next one that popped up most was Hey Bulldog.
Yeah, okay. So, that's a great bass line, but it's also the core riff of the whole song, isn't it? It's the piano, it's the bass, it's the guitar.
Yeah, but when the bass gets into the verse, so it's not just the...
I know, you're right, yeah.
You're going... It's just moving constantly, isn't it?
And it needs to, because there's a lot of space in that song.
Yeah.
And that's where McCartney, he doesn't like space.
No, sometimes he's seized by the need to fill the gap, isn't he? Which is why he sometimes gets criticised for the bass part on Something.
Yeah, because it feels like...
Although loads of people say Something's one of his best bass lines, because it is. It's beautifully melodic. Yeah, so Dave Hwang, Tim Kellaway, Patrick Connor, Sean Farrell, and dear old Hugh from Teetlemania all suggested Hey Bulldog.
Mm.
And then there was lots of other ones. So Paperback Writer and Rain got a lot of love. So our pal Tim Worthington suggested Rain. He said it even sounds like the scattershot way that rain hits your window when you first notice that it's raining, which is a lovely way to think of it. You know, that's a very interesting image to take from it. But yeah, I can see that totally.
All the hammer-ons and things that he does in it.
And we get Dr. Christine Feldman Barrett. Hi, Christine. Paperback Writer / Rain. What a great single in terms of showcasing Paul's breathtaking bass skills.
Yeah.
Completely. I love Paperback Writer. It's one of my absolute favourites for his bass part. I play so much Paperback Writer style stuff on my band stuff.
Yeah, when he's really, like, even before they went full on, George took that kind of, what's the name of the scale, like the Indian type of scale thing.
Yeah.
Paul was playing around with that stuff so much already, wasn't he, as far as his bass lines go. Yeah, and once you get into that, you can really get a groove going on with that kind of stuff, can't you?
Yeah, so we have Lisa who says Rain, insanely good song and a B-side better than most bands' A-sides. Simon Hart says Rain is amazing. Oh, so who else have we got on here? So Gillian Riley says The Word is a favourite of mine. I love that song, The Word, and that's got a real groove to it. So that's a really good example of a groovy bass line, a feel type thing. Vicky Riley says, when we were younger and just getting into the Beatles, me and my pals used to play Guess the Beatles song by singing the bass lines to each other, which is great, including playing them rhythmically on the zips on their coats, I believe. Which is
But, that sounds like a very challenging game.
But it goes to show how important these parts are, aren't they? You know, it's not... It's not just a
No,
you can do that stuff when he needs to, but you can identify a song by the bass line.
There's nearly every single Beatles song, the bass line is identifiable from, isn't it?
Yeah.
As in, it's not just like you say, not just hitting the beat on the every, you know, not just hitting the crotchet beat. It's something about it which makes you go, oh, it's even if it's just a passing note or a twiddle or something, he's done something.
Yeah. So what else have we got? We've got Vicky the Lab Rat says, it has to be Day Tripper for me. I remember the joy of nailing it on Rock Band.
Yeah.
Day Tripper is... I mean, there's a few here where actually what he's doing is stuff the your double guitar parts. And it's hard to tell sometimes. Has the guitar part come first and the bass part come second or the other way around? Mm. So Day Tripper does that. Drive My Car does that as well, which a few folk have mentioned. And Hey Bulldog does it to some extent as well. So you have that sort of thickness of sound going on that makes these guitar songs. Alex Livingston, who says, I'm a bassist, so I've thought about this a lot. He gave us a list of a few, but he mentions, oddly, probably the weirdest one that anyone's mentioned is What Goes On. He says, maybe not a spectacular song, but he and Ringo are killing it on that one.
Because when it goes into the...
Goes into the walking part, doesn't
it? Yeah, it really picks it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. So So let's quick run through some of the others. Dom Reed suggests Getting Better. Fantastic. Yeah. Couple of votes for Taxman from Daniel Green and Nostal. Matt Whitten, that bit in Everybody's Got Something to Hide. You know it.
Oh, yeah.
And I do know it.
It's just that little uprun, isn't it?
Yeah, that bit.
But the whole song is doing stuff like that as well, though.
Yeah. Raymond Terrific says, Penny Lane is so insanely melodic. Tomorrow Never Knows, combined with Ringo, is the opposite, but it's pure innovation, groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Captain Rona, Penny Lane is always a favourite. So amazing, the bass on Penny Lane.
Yeah.
That's descending walking bass. Daniel Green suggests Something, Another Day, See Your Sunshine and Taxman. So there's a couple of solo ones in there.
Yeah.
And Mark Crilly, hi Mark. We have to give an honourable mention to the mouth bass he plays on I Will. Which you do, because I Will is such a beautiful little McCartney miniature with a, you know, little Beatles-y touches on it. But yeah, he's doing a bass on it, but he's doing it, he's singing it.
Yeah.
And it's still a great bass line. You know, it's amazing. I Will is an amazing song. I couldn't decide when I made my little list of whether I'd put Mother Nature's Son or I Will on there, but it's...
brilliant. Was there any more? Sorry, I didn't...
No, that's it. Someone's I've cribbed out of it. There's a couple more. But thank you everyone for your thoughts on that. It's interesting to see what came out.
I think that just goes to show there's not that many bands where you can say, what are your best bass lines? And there'd be just so much to talk about.
Yeah.
There'd be lots of bands where you go, oh, well, they were a good bassist, but what would I pull out as... Whereas we can talk about the bass lines to his songs almost as, you know, as much detail as you can talk about the song in itself.
Yeah.
Because they're so distinctive and got so much character. Yeah, brilliant.
Fantastic. So anything else you want to talk about before we finish, Gary?
Just a quick mention of something in my kind of recuperation. I've been watching a lot of telly, as you can expect. And one of the things I watched last week was the Disney Plus series Pistols, which I highly recommend to people. But then as someone who's not really got much knowledge of the Sex Pistols, it was all very informative for me. So if you know a lot about them, you might already find it. You might find it goes counter to what you think. I don't know. Apparently it's based on Steve Jones's book. So I think it's fairly accurate from what I can understand. However, the reason I'm mentioning it is because there's the Paul McCartney link to that as well, which dawned on me, which is the story goes that the original bassist, Glenn Matlock, who was kind of with them when they were getting, he was in that famous Grundy interview. And, you know, he was with them at that point. The story goes that he was sacked primarily because Malcolm McLaren wanted Sid Vicious in the band, mainly because he didn't think Glenn Matlock fitted the image. I think the whole idea was Glenn Matlock was an actual kind of a musical bloke. You know, he was actually a good player. And although Steve Jones went on to become one, he at the time had to kind of learn guitar from scratch. And the drummer was good. And it wasn't so much that. One of the things that often gets cited is that he was openly a fan of the Beatles and Paul McCartney, especially being a bassist as well. And that's kind of one of the reasons he got nudged out of the band. But after they'd all kind of written most of the songs that ended up on their one and only iconic album, of which Glenn Matlock himself, I think, is something like 10 out of the 12 songs he co-wrote with them. And when we say co-wrote, I think he came up with quite a few of them. He was quite a big influence on quite a lot of the songs. So actually, despite the kind of famous thing being, you know, the Sex Pistols, the kind of band that would sack you if you like the Beatles, the majority of their output is written largely influenced by someone who was an open fan of the Beatles and Paul McCartney. And I really like that link. When I was thinking about it, it was like, well, hang on a second, because they're very similar in their career paths in that they're coming around and they're reinvigorating music. They're bringing something new. So it's just got me. I just thought it was an interesting link. And they even have a scene where Glenn Matlock in one of their dirty dressing rooms on their northern tour, kind of when they're saying this is rubbish, he tries to cheer them up by saying, you know, we're going to the toppermost of the poppermost, and they all like have a go at him for it. And then that got me thinking. I wonder what Paul McCartney and Lennon thought of the Sex Pistols. And they were both fans.
Yeah.
They both saw the parallels between them and the Beatles, especially John Lennon was saying, back, you know, they were already spitting on stage and doing horrible things when they were in Hamburg. They weren't, you know, it wasn't nice, they were living a very raw, raucous lifestyle that they had to clean up. And he was quite glad to see that a band could kind of be a bit more like that and still get famous without having to pretend that, you know.
Yeah, the difference always was that, you know, the punk movement was more founded in the notion of nihilism and the sort of nothing matters.
Yeah.
Whereas the sort of Beatles Hamburg years didn't really have a philosophy until essentially they met the Exes and you know, Astrid and Jürgen and all that lot, who sort of suggested it. Existentialism rather than nihilism. So yeah, but yeah, otherwise.
Yeah, and McCartney was meant to be such a big fan that Johnny Rotten he tried to accost him in the street. He came in Linda McCartney across the road to try and talk to him, and Johnny Rotten got so nervous he just drove off.
Yeah.
Because he's a big fan, he's gone on record to say he was a big fan, especially of Pretty Vacant.
Yeah, but it's funny because the 70s was obviously, there was a lot of backlash against these big, what people were calling the rock dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And one of the jokes in the Ruttles, so we get a Ruttles mention in here, is the idea that Dirk McQuickley's post-Ruttles career is him in The Punk Floyd.
Yeah.
Which is a way of sort of making a joke about the bands of the 70s that dominated.
Yeah.
Really. And actually, McCartney did all sorts of stuff. He's done his own punky stuff anyway. And it's, you know, and then everyone will make the statement about, you know, is punk the music or the attitude? Well, obviously it's a combination of the both and stuff. So it's interesting.
What surprised me, but as a relatively, you know, uneducated Pistols person, basically, is actually how good the music actually was. I always thought they were meant to be quite shambolic. They're actually really good. And one of the reasons is because there's a backbone of there, someone who actually was interested in good music, and they all liked good music. They just didn't like, it was just an attitude thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it remains one of the big punk sort of ideas or myths that the bands couldn't play. Mm. Now, I mean, a lot of them originated in that, like, out of nowhere sense of, like, we're just going to form a band.
Yeah.
You know, here's three chords, form a band type thing. But actually, by the time most of them get on record,
yeah,
they wouldn't have been put out if they were that awful. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can hunt out some dreadful, dreadful punk records. Mm. But if they were, as lots of people describe them, then it would be completely unlistenable outsider art rather than music. And it's not most of it. It's listenable. It's listenable hard rock of its own sort.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to put out that parallel because it's zeitgeisty in that. I'm sure there are other people currently who are enjoying that Disney Plus series, and I would recommend it. It was lots of fun.
Well, I've got another McCartney parallel.
Okay, on then.
That Thomas Brodie Sangster plays Malcolm McLaren.
Yes.
In that series.
Ah, yeah.
And he played Paul McCartney in Nowhere Boy.
He did indeed. I just dawned on me as you were saying it. Yeah, yeah. He did play Paul McCartney, and he's a great actor. Except that he's just got such a little baby face. He never looks. You can never imagine actually being the people. Although Malcolm McLaren, he's just got such a distinctive little face. He also plays Ferb in Phineas and Ferb, doesn't he?
He does play the voice of the not very often heard voice of Ferb in Phineas and Ferb.
So all the major universes have been linked.
Yeah, that's it. Everything there, all the key figures in popular culture history:
Paul McCartney,
Malcolm McLaren, and Ferb from Phineas and Ferb.
Yeah. Great.
Do you think Paul McCartney's ever watched Phineas and Ferb?
Oh, I don't know.
He's got grandkids, hasn't
he? You never know. That's the kind of thing no one ever thinks to ask him.
If you had a chance for one question, would you panic and ask Paul McCartney if he's ever watched Phineas and Ferb?
Possibly, because I'd be so worried about keep doing such a rubbish interview like what's his face.
Imagine if he just came back with Perry the Platypus.
he might have composed a lot of their songs.
Yeah. Oh dear.
There'll be some link between him and that, because there is a band, isn't there, who do a lot of the songs, and there'll be some.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure you can track it down somewhere.
Well, we already have
Thomas Brodie Sangster link. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah, there we go.
So, I guess we should finish by saying a big happy birthday to Paul McCartney. I'm sure he's listening and has enjoyed.
Merry happy.
Enjoyed all of this. And if anyone listens to this who knows a way to let him know that we're saying happy birthday, then please do.
Yeah.
Great, thanks Paul, it's been lovely talking again, and we will be back with another special at least before series 3 we're going to start recording over summer and start putting out into the autumn, I'd think, so that we've got a bit under our belts, so you've got that to look forward to, and we'll see you when we see you.
Okay,
goodbye everybody.
Merry McCartney.